Welcome to Common Good, the Values in Capitalism podcast, brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute. This is Tyler Castle coming from downtown Washington, D.C. in the 11th floor studio at AEI. I'm joined by Brad Wasink, who is the program manager of AEI's new program on human flourishing. Hey, Brad, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me, Tyler.
Thanks for joining us for a few minutes. So I just want to give our listeners a little view into this new initiative. What's the point of it? What are you trying to accomplish? If you could just talk about that, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So the program on human flourishing is our new effort broadly to show how free enterprise gives the most people the greatest opportunity to create a better life. And it kind of has two prongs. One is a massive communication surge where we educate leaders, where we author op-eds, where we host events, all things that people see publicly in an effort to change the debate about how free enterprise mm-hmm. gives people opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then the second component is a broad-based and greatly expanded research agenda on issues pertaining to human flourishing. Mm-hmm. So whether that's relief in meeting the physical needs of people, we just brought on a new scholar, Robert Dorr, who I think was on last week on the podcast.
He's actually on this episode.
Oh, is he?
Yeah,
that's
terrific.
And also whether it's social mobility, our economics team has been working on that. How do mm-hmm. we make sure that kids who grow up in tough circumstances have a good shot at a better situation than their parents had?
Absolutely. Is there anyone else doing this sort of thing, or did you kind of see a void in this area and that's where AEI is trying to step in?
Well, I think there has been a lot of research work in this area. I think the unique space is that particularly those on the right have kind of let this area lie fallow, even though market-based ideas, the research shows, are most effective in helping people get out of poverty. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the best statistics is of those who work full-time year-round, regardless of wage, the poverty rate is less than 3%.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing that we're committed to showing.
Yeah. That's great. So Arthur Brooks wrote a piece in Commentary Magazine a couple months ago, I think it was in mm-hmm. January, and it was entitled Be Open-Handed to Your Brothers. Is that kind of a founding document for this in a lot of ways? I mean, I know you've talked to me about, you know, there's three kind of prongs of this: relief, transformation, and opportunity. Those are kind of the three things that we think poor people need to kind of develop and become.
Yeah, and everyone needs. It's not just the least
Absolutely,
among
yeah.
us, but definitely, I think that document lays out in a very eloquent way mm-hmm. why it's necessary. We can't just provide relief. That's what we've learned, is that just meeting people's physical needs without giving them the tools that they need to move up, and without the supporting institutions that give what they do value and meaning, mm-hmm. ultimately efforts to relief will not be successful.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, some people really do need relief.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of the three prongs, is that mm-hmm. we can't just say, oh, civil society will fill this void. There is a role for government there, mm-hmm. and there is a role there for providing relief, but it has to be supported by those other things that give people the opportunity to improve their circumstances, and with the support network that lets them feel valued, even though their wages might not be the greatest.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing a little bit, Brad. As Brad mentioned, our guest this episode is Robert Dorr, who's AEI's new poverty scholar, plays a central role in this new initiative. My boss, Josh Good, and I will have a great conversation with him about his experience with welfare policy in New York City. And because this was recorded before the final games were played, he gives us his prediction for who's going to come out on top of the NCAA basketball tournament. You'll have to listen to the end and see if he was right. Thanks again, Brad.
Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah, of course. All right, we'll take a quick break and be back with Robert Dorr.
Is this just an illusion?
Back with our guest, Robert Dorr, the Mortgage Fellow in Poverty Studies here at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and evaluates how free enterprise and improved federal policy and programming can reduce poverty and provide opportunities for vulnerable Americans. Before joining AEI, Dorr was Commissioner of New York City's Human Resources Administration, where he administered 12 public assistance programs for the largest local social services agency in the United States. Among the programs he oversaw were welfare, food assistance, and public health insurance. And now over to our host, Tyler Castle.
Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Happy to be here.
So when I first told my friends that we had a new poverty scholar at AEI, who before he came to AEI had been the welfare administrator in New York City, they typically reply, "Wait, and he's a conservative?" And so,
well, that's right. We have a New York City had an interesting political history in the last 20 years. Mayor Giuliani was mayor for 8 years, and mm-hmm. he ran on the Republican line. And then Michael Bloomberg was mayor for 12 years, and he won all three of his elections on the Republican line. And so he had a pretty eclectic administration, and he drew certainly liberals and Democrats and Republicans and sometimes even conservatives. And so I've been a Republican. I worked for Governor Pataki prior to coming to work for Michael Bloomberg. And on welfare policy, I don't know whether I'm conservative or liberal or Republican or Democrat. What I am is, I think, got an approach that I think is successful at getting people into employment and moving up the economic ladder. At least that's what I think. It's hard work. It's not easy to be successful. I think when you put away the ideological labels and just focus on what is successful for people, you find that employment is really the most important thing you can do for low-income Americans.
Fair enough. Could you just describe a little bit what you achieved in New York City? We were talking a couple weeks ago, and it's pretty impressive what you were able to do with welfare in New York City.
Well, there's three big things that happened in welfare policy over the course of welfare reform, starting about 1995. And I worked at the state level in the beginning and then at the city level during the period. And there were others, but these were the three biggest. The first is the welfare cash caseload dropped from more than 1.1 million to less than 350,000. So that's a big reduction in the number of people that were getting a cash benefit, you know, a check with no strings attached, just a sort of the basic dole, 700,000 person reduction in that. That was one achievement. We also significantly increased work rates for single mothers and for never married single mothers who are the most likely to be on welfare. And they rose throughout the city from about less than 50% to well over 60%. So big drop increase there. And in the years period right after welfare reform began, in the late 90s up until the beginning of 2000s, child poverty and poverty generally dropped significantly in a way that it doesn't and hasn't in other periods. So real significant achievement there. Now, since then, that's kind of leveled off. Labor force participation has stayed high and the caseload has remained low. Poverty, we've not been able to get much further lower than we were, and it's ticked up with this most recent recession a little bit. So that's discouraging. Mm-hmm. But those three accomplishments of caseload reduction, significant increases in work rates for single moms who are most likely to be on welfare, and child poverty reductions were significant achievements.
Okay, so it's not just like you're reducing the amount of people on welfare and they're milling around on the streets. They're actually getting they got jobs.
Well, I don't know if anybody's been into one of the, you know, 50 neighborhoods in New York City or 70 neighborhoods in New York City, but we have a very vibrant city, and yeah. there are struggling areas. There are areas mm-hmm. that are still tough and difficult, but by and large, the number of workers in New York City is at its all-time high. In fact, more people are employed in New York City than ever before. So we had the benefit of a fairly vibrant economy. But notwithstanding, we took advantage of that. You know, in the old days, what Daniel Patrick Moynihan found and discovered, and it was odd, that in good times in the 60s and 70s, when the economy was improving, welfare caseloads were rising, which makes no sense. As unemployment would go down, mm-hmm. welfare would still go up. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. In New York City, we reversed that. So as the economy, we took advantage of the strong economy for our poorest citizens, and that was a good thing.
Come to think of it, I think we have a picture of some scissors and a Values and Capitalism monograph on this line.
That's right, we do.
Home Economics by Nick Schultz. A little commercial for that. We'll have to come back to that.
That's right. That's the
I'm glad that wasn't
effect.
Happening, though,
that
in New York City. That's
New
good
York
to hear.
City during the last period.
So you wrote an article that came out today for Real Clear Markets that kind of brought up the problem of when you do have developing cities where there is a vibrant, growing economy, one of the problem is that there's not very much affordable housing. So what can we do about that? I know in D.C. especially, it's with gentrification and development, there's a lot of communities that used to be really affordable, not, you know, very expensive. And now they're, you know, it's $800 a month to rent a small apartment. So,
well, that's a that's a very good question. And it was a very difficult frustration for the members of the Bloomberg administration, including myself. This was one area in the area of homelessness where we were not as successful as we wanted to be, and where we had to deal with the difficulties that come with a growing and very prosperous and very hot real estate market. Neighborhoods that in the past were kind of zoned off limits because of crime and difficulty and problems really opened up in the last 20 years and became vibrant and economically integrated areas where more and more people of all kinds, middle-class people, rich people, poor people, were living together. But when that happens, and when you become a popular city, a destination place for workers and and employers, it puts a pressure on the housing market. And that pressure led to more New Yorkers than ever having to turn to the city for help by staying in our shelter system. Now, we have a very expansive and I think a very solid shelter system that's humane and decent and kind. It's not perfect. But we have a right to shelter in the city of New York. So if you cannot find a place to stay, we will put you up. So we have very low street homelessness, but we have very high sheltered homelessness. And that up to about almost 50,000 men, women, and children on any given night. And that's the problem. And we really struggle with that. And, you know, I used to say sometimes Mayor Bloomberg had an eclectic group of advisors. He had very compassionate people. He had very strong Democrats and liberals, and he had me and a few others who were a little more conservative. But we were capable people, I think, and we tried hard.
Yeah.
And the mayor gave us a lot of leeway, and we couldn't solve it. Mm. So I think it can be solved. There are issues that we got to build more housing. But it also revealed the limitations of government, that you have to be reasonable and rational about how much we can accomplish and about promising too much. The mayor, I love Mayor Bloomberg, but he made a commitment that he was going to cut the homeless population in half, and it went the other way. So you have to be conscious of what you're promising and what the limitations of government are. But in any case, I would never trade the economic prosperity we had, the reductions in child poverty, the increases in work rates for single mothers, the reduction in welfare caseloads, for a better homeless situation. I want them both. I want fewer homeless, and I want a strong, prosperous city as well. But it does put pressures, and you're right, and it's difficult. And sometimes relocation is a good idea to places where housing is more affordable. But that's a hard thing to say to people that love the city of New York or love the DC, District of Columbia, and don't want to leave where they grew up and where their families were. So that's a hard one.
Okay. Yeah. Going back to your time doing welfare policy in general, what was the one biggest lesson that you learned about welfare policy, about how to do it well from your time in New York?
I think the biggest lesson I learned was that we provide a tremendous amount of assistance to people, and we haven't talked about what I call work supports that shores up low wages, but which we'll do that in a minute. But we provide assistance and case management and help to people. But we cannot do it alone. The client, the recipient, the citizen who's in need has to accept that the key to their future is going to be their actions and their willingness to take personal responsibility. Now, the fact is thousands and thousands of New Yorkers every day did that and came to our offices and said, what do I need to do to get a job? What do I need to help my children, help my family? And they stepped up and they went to work, as I mentioned, in big numbers. So it's not a surprise that would be the case. But for us in government, who sometimes want to say, I will or we will or government will solve this problem, if we get too much into that rhetoric, that gets into the whole atmosphere of the agency, and it then gets into the culture of the community, into people thinking that they'll solve it for us. And they won't. We can help, but you have to have personal choices and personal responsibility to get us to the starting line.
So, Robert, as I understand, you had something like 9,000 employees at HRA. Can you say a little bit about how you coached or led or managed that staff team so that they could do just that?
Well, we had 14,000.
Wow.
And I was a big walker arounder and go out to see everybody and talk to people. First of all, I said thank you quite a lot. I said thank you for your service. Thank you for serving the city of New York. Appreciate your work. These were, career civil servants, bureaucrats, government employees, but they were wonderful people who I'm very proud to have been associated with. And they came to work for the agency that they worked for, A, to get a job, but also B, because they wanted to help people. But they knew, because they came from communities that often were poor, and they knew as well as anybody that they could not help someone who wasn't willing to start out and help themselves too. So we talked about that, and it became, I think, kind of reassuring to them to know that I would say, and the mayor's leadership would say, don't take the whole burden for solving the person's problem on your shoulders. Know that they have that you have help and can and ask for help from them. And it made, I think, their life and their jobs, which were very difficult. They saw lots of people every day that are in strife and in crisis and are angry and don't like being asked to turn over a document or to show up at a meeting. But when they knew that it wasn't all on them, I think it was liberating. But mainly what I did was say thank you, because government service is important. Service of any kind is important, in the not-for-profit and the community sector as well. But I was very respectful of the efforts that they put in.
It seems like now more than ever, though, the value of work in our culture and society is being doubted, if that makes sense. I think of the response to the CBO report about Obamacare, where they said it's going to cut 2.5 million jobs. And some people, especially progressive, kind of cheered for that, saying, you know, people won't have to work. They'll be able to have health insurance without having work. Do you think it is a cultural problem that we need to
I never saw it in New York. New York is a very, very intense working place.
People are motivated.
People are up and at them, and they don't. It's so competitive, and it's so, you know, you just feel it when you're in the city that everybody's on the make a little bit. They're trying to get out there and get going. So I never felt that the value of work was disintegrated. And I should point out, I ran an agency that provided an enormous amount of assistance in food stamp benefits to working people, in public health insurance to working people, and other kinds of assistance, and promoted the earned income tax credit to working people. And so I have a little bit of disagreement with some of the more conservative commentators who feel that any form of assistance is a work disincentive. I don't think that's true, and I think that work assistance can incentivize work as opposed to discourage work. I think that now that was New York. I'm discouraged by the reaction to the CBO report. I agree with you. I think that there does seem to be, and certainly labor force participation has dropped, and it's only ticked up a little bit in the last month, but it's low and back in 1970s eras. That's not good, and we do not want to go back to an idea in America where the way we shore up people's wages is just give them money and say, well, that solved poverty, because that won't work. That didn't work in the past, and you have to remember, I worked in offices in New York City that were called job centers. That's what we called all of our offices that saw people who were applying for welfare. They used to be called income maintenance centers, IM centers, income maintenance centers. Think of that. The government was going to say to people, our job is to maintain your income.
Yeah.
Well, I don't agree with that. That didn't work. I don't want to go back to that. I don't like the fact that some there seems to be in the current Washington environment a more increase in increasing dependency as opposed to limiting it and basing it on work, which is what I think was most important.
I think in many ways the environment in New York City is just – it's a lot different than the rest of the country. It's very entrepreneurial. Like you said, if you're in New York City, it's a lot of people who, you know, maybe just came to the country or who are going to New York City to kind of make their dreams happen. So do you think the successes that you had there can be replicated throughout the nation, considering how distinct New York City and its culture is?
Well, a stronger economy would help the country as a whole. A 4% growth rate would be a lot better than what we have. And while I love New York, I never felt that there weren't lots of places all across America where that kind of economic vibrancy could occur. You're right about the immigrant population. A lot of people come to New York who want to go to take advantage of opportunity, and they really excite and invigorate our neighborhoods from the immigrant population. But I think it can happen across the country. The mayor said a strong message about it too. I mean, the mayor was not a whiner. The mayor was not somebody who, when someone said, you know, the wage at that job is only $9.50 or it's only $8. He didn't say, well, that's terrible, that's awful. He said, it's a start, and then we can help shore up those wages with work supports. He said, every job is a step up from unemployment. And so he set a message of a kind of expectation, maybe the word toughness is too strong, but a resiliency and a self-reliance. And so I think that message is sometimes not as strongly presented around the country as a whole. But I definitely think that once we get our economy growing at a more rapid rate, that kind of vibrancy will occur all across America.
Robert, a lot of our listeners are coming at this from an evangelical point of view. They're Christian college students or professors, in some cases administrators, and others who are now working. And for a lot of us, there's a sense that somehow work is tied to our humanness, this idea of stewardship of the earth, and that you reflect the image of God actually by tending the land and tilling the earth, working and subduing the earth. Any thoughts about sort of the moral or even the theological underpinnings for the value of work?
Well, here's what I know. Communities and neighborhoods that have people that get up in the morning and go to work are healthier. They're more vibrant. They're more caring of each other. They're less involved in unnecessary and problematic behavior. So I believe that that discipline and rigor and outward lookingness that work brings to a person or a family is essential for human flourishing and for prosperity as an individual and as a community. So I absolutely believe that. There was a fairly well-known New York Times special feature in the wake of welfare reform on one block in northern Manhattan in Harlem. And it talked about the transformation of that block when the culture of and the expectation and the hope and the opportunity for work on a daily basis became much more common than it had been in more difficult times. And the neighborhood changed, and for the better, and in all kinds of ways. And so, absolutely, it was there. And on the other hand, in welfare policy, just to say, but while we might talk about that, we also put it in a more harsh way, which was the contract between government and you seeking assistance implies that it's reciprocal. That if you want assistance from us, you need to do certain things. So I have to say, if you were asking me honestly what my rhetoric was more about, it was probably more about that second, which is I'm in charge of a program.
A little tough love.
In order for perceived assistance, you need to go to work or you need to participate. Mm-hmm. But I believed that message, and along with the other one about the positive aspects of work, could inculcate a value that was stronger for a community. And I strongly believe that. This is important. My employees believe that. Mm-hmm. They believed, and again, these are predominantly African-American, predominantly Hispanic, predominantly women, too. They believed that that their participation in working in the program that we were working was part of their personal
well-being.
Fulfillment.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And I should also point out that HRA was a place where God's love was all over, and one of the great things that happened at HRA all the time, and I never got to talk about it much, but I can hear, was the extent to which people greet each other by saying "Have a blessed day," and there are some people maybe out there that would worry about that, or maybe the commissioner shouldn't echo that, but I did.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the Walmart ads that have been out in the last couple of weeks about the meaning that work gives you, the purpose that it gives you in life. It really is inspiring. And when you think about people who, you know, don't have a lot, just being able to get up every day, be a part of a team, have a purpose, and have something to accomplish with your life, it's pretty It's a big part of your life, I think.
Yeah. It is. But I also should say that it's also important that, work be rewarding financially.
Yeah.
Let's not kid around here, and that when someone goes to work, they also are entitled to be compensated for it. And I wish wages and rate were higher. I wish the return for labor was greater than it is right now. But the thing is, in welfare policy and in poverty programs, that Democrats don't ever want to mention, except when they support the program and have to fight for it, is that we have a whole array of programs that provide significant financial assistance to make wages go further. So if you're talking about a mom with two kids going to work every day, having the benefits of work that they're having, and getting paid, say, $8 an hour, well, a mom with two kids at $8 an hour full time is also entitled to, not just in New York City, but around the country, a very significant earned income tax credit that shores up that wage and that she appreciates. And food stamp benefits also are available to that sort of worker, and probably public health insurance for the children. So this idea that well, that's all nice and good, but the wages are so low that the work isn't fairly compensated is a point people can make. But it has to be looked at in the whole picture. Well, wait a minute. What do we do as a society to shore up that low wage? And when we look at it from that perspective, it's rewarding. And that's why they stayed in work, by the way. They went to work, found these things, shored up low wages, and stuck with it. So while I love the dignity of work, I'm also a capitalist, and work's got to be rewarding financially too. And sometimes that reward doesn't only come from the wage payer, the employer. In the United States now, a lot of that reward comes from assistance tied to work that is intended to reward work with further supports.
You bet. And a lot of our students who do work directly with populations that are sometimes recipients of welfare or working at low-wage jobs don't really have a sense of some of those benefits that help kind of give people a hand up. And for us as students and people just getting started, often not interacting with the public welfare system, public assistance benefits system, it helps to kind of hear some of this and maybe even help be able to point some of our low-income friends to some of these resources that can help them sustain their work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's and I don't want to, there are the great individualists who have a strong view about any kind of dependency, and I respect that and honor that. And I don't want to, be accused of converting great individualists into government lovers. But for a low-wage worker who is working at a low wage, there are places they can go to use the tax code, the earned income tax credit, to get a little additional assistance. And people that are working with people who are struggling should know about that and should educate people about it.
Yeah, it certainly helps to debunk the myth we often hear talked about in public rhetoric.
Right.
Progressives are still kind of touting the minimum wage policy, and you just laid out all of these alternatives to supplementing wages rather than kind of setting a ceiling or floor for where wages are. Do you think we'll ever just get over the minimum wage policy and realize that there's better ways to do that? Or do you think in some places there should be a minimum wage? Or
no, I'm not a big minimum wage fan, or certainly raising the minimum wage at the rates that it's at now, first particularly nationally, because labor markets are so different all across the country. And there are places where there really is very little work, and if you raise the minimum wage, you'll have even less work, and that's not good. I also don't like raising the minimum wage because it ignores these supports that exist. It pretends they don't exist, and they do, and so that bothers me. I also don't like it because we have some particularly young men and teenagers that would be forced further out of the labor market, which is not good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we'll ever get over it because it's a simple issue that Democrats can talk about in a way that gets misinterpreted. Although I do think we're making some progress. I think the debate has been informed by some of the things that Republicans and conservatives have said that said this is not the best way to help the poor. I was really struck by this event we had here at AEI where the first spokesman for the most strong proponent of the minimum wage, I think the first or second thing out of her mouth was, a minimum wage increase is not really an anti-poverty program. Well, if it's not an anti-poverty program, then why are we doing it? I mean, we want to help. And in fact, it has some downside consequences to poor people. And I just think that when you look at the big picture of America, one thing we should be thinking about is the less fortunate. And we shouldn't be basing our policies on helping people that that might hurt, policies that might hurt the less fortunate because we want to help somebody else. So I think a minimum wage hike, particularly to $10.10 nationally, is not good for low-income Americans. It's not good for poor kids, and we should not do it.
Fair enough. So we're about out of time, but I wanted to you shared a fun fact with us a few weeks ago, which is that you once went dancing at the NCAA basketball tournament as a member of the Princeton basketball team, which I think you're probably, I'm confident saying you're the only person at AEI who can say that.
Let's be clear. I was a scrub. I did not get to dress, but I did. The coach did allow me and two other members of what we called the green team, which basically only played defense in practice against the superstars. And we got to go on the trip to the NCAAs when I was a sophomore. And Danny Ainge and Brigham Young University, after being behind by 7.5, came got their act together and beat the Princeton Tigers in a very sad game.
Well, you don't have to qualify. You just need to say you were in March Madness. But since you're an expert in it, obviously, you've been there. Who's going to win this year? We've got Florida, UConn, Wisconsin, or Kentucky. Who's your pick?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. All right. You heard it there first. Thanks for joining us, Robert. It was great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back next time.